Okay, folks, welcome once again. This is Elvin Shamroth, and this is our last teleseminar for the year. Basically, in 2 weeks' time, in essence, everyone will have completed their exam, and we move on to next year's crop. But even at the very end of the season, we still have new people joining us. So I'm just going to share very briefly. We've got one person who submitted two cases to us, and it's unrehearsed. I don't know where the conversation will go, but she's sent an email to me with two cases, and I hope she's with us in this teleconference. And we'll see where the conversation goes. I looked at the cases. They're interesting cases, and they are good for everyone listening in. So it'll be an interesting, worthwhile conversation. So let me see. Ariane, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much for submitting your two cases. I appreciate it very much. you've got two cases. Take whichever one you want first. Go ahead and present it as succinctly as you can, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay. I'll do my GYN case. This
okay.
is a 23-year-old G0. She was referred to me by her primary care doctor for an incidental finding of an 8-centimeter simple right ovarian cyst that was suspicious for an endometrioma. She originally got the ultrasound done by her primary care doctor for a workup of AUB and pelvic pain. She also had a family history of endometriosis. She was counseled and given the risk of ovarian torsion, she was recommended to undergo a right ovarian cystectomy. She also desired to evaluate her pelvis for endometriosis, given the suspicious history. Intra-op, she did not have any endometriosis. And
can I interrupt you for 1 second? And I think it's important for me to mention here, for the sake of your sake and everyone that's listening in, we've got a young patient, nulliparous woman, 23 years old. And you acknowledge she's got an 8-centimeter cyst. You are, as I understand it, suspecting that this may have torsed. And you're counseling her that she needs a cystectomy. Did I get that correct thus far?
Correct. And she also desired evaluation for suspected endometriosis.
Okay, but the point that I want to make is this. There was a practice bulletin probably about 5 years ago, which was entitled Torsion in Adolescence. Now, I acknowledge she's not an adolescent at age 23, but she is very young, and she's got her entire reproductive career ahead of her, given the fact that she's a para-zero. And the point that they make in this practice bulletin is if they are symptomatic and you feel that maybe you should take them to the OR, the bottom line of this practice bulletin is that you should be quick to take them to the OR. But once you're in the OR, you should be slow to remove the adnexum or the ovary or the cyst. You should just be conservative and untwist where possible. So the only reason why I'm interrupting you is on a technicality. You said you counseled her on having a cystectomy or oophorectomy. I think it's better, given what I've just shared with you, to not – you presented it as if you're – suggesting that she should have this done. And the option of choice is to untwist and only remove if forced to. And that's the issue that I just want to bring to everyone. It's a question of how you present the case. You want to try and be as conservative as possible. So, Ariane, you understand the point that I'm making here. And counseling is actually a very important issue. And this is a good example. This would not trip you up, but it's something very small that could potentially give the wrong impression to the examiner. So I just want you to be aware of that. You understand the point I'm making?
So being specific and saying I recommended detorsing, not necessarily.
Yeah, I got the impression that you felt the best line of therapy for this patient was removal, and you can't say that until you're looking at it in the OR. The best option, according to this practice bulletin, is untwisting, and only if you feel that that's not viable or feasible. Then you got to remove. So the counseling should be, we will try and save the ovary, but if we can't, we'll remove it, as opposed to we'll remove it. You see the subtle difference. I'm trying to just present the practice bulletin's opinion, which is telling us to be that much more conservative. That's all. Not a big deal, but I just want you to be aware of that. That's all. Do you follow the point I'm making?
Yes, I understand that. Not removing,
okay.
Doing oophorectomy, but what about recommending an ovarian cystectomy?
So I've got to be honest. I believe untwisting still comes first, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Try and untwist if you can. If you can get away with it. You can't always in all cases. I just want you folks, and this is the take-home message here, I want you always throughout your exam, and especially on the GYN side, to be seen to be promoting and pushing conservatism wherever possible. That's the only point. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. So
all right.
I'll just say I recommend.
Yeah, it's just how you present it, that's all. It's not a big deal,
correct.
But I want you to shine. Okay, I interrupted you. Go ahead, carry on.
Okay. So I recommended evaluation of her pelvis given her pelvic pain and ovarian cysts and the risk of ovarian torsion. Intra-op, she had a normal appearing pelvis except for the simple appearing 8-centimeter right ovarian cyst, which was not torsed. I proceeded with an ovarian cystectomy. The cyst was incidentally ruptured during the ovarian cystectomy, and it was noted in the ovarian cyst wall that there were some abnormal appearing gray papillary excrescences seen. I proceeded with the ovarian cystectomy. I did acknowledge that it appeared abnormal, and I elected to wait the final pathology, which returned as a borderline serous tumor.
Okay, and you feel bad because this turned out to be a borderline serous tumor, and furthermore, the cyst ruptured during its dissection. Is that your major concern?
Correct. I wouldn't have done anything differently.
That's exactly the point I was going to ask you. Folks, for all of you listening in, because each and every one of you have complications of one form or other, or surprise findings of one form or other, and you deal with them. And in the vast majority of cases, even though you had perhaps a bad outcome or a negative subsequent finding, the question you've got to ask yourself and actually say this verbally to your examiner in the exam, you got to ask yourself and you say, you know, I've considered how this patient presented and how she was worked up and the management that she received. And although this had an unfortunate outcome, I've given this a lot of thought, And I have to be honest, if I was presented with this same patient again, I would manage her exactly the same way. If you say that and you believe it, it's a very powerful statement. Remember, we're not God. We can't treat everything perfectly. We can't save every life. This is just the nature of the practice that we're working in. So I want you to be comfortable to say in the exam, you know, as much as it was an unfortunate outcome, if I had this patient again, I would do exactly the same thing. What's the probability of a 23-year-old having a borderline tumor? I mean, it's so infinitesimally small. So I really would not worry about that. But there are a couple of questions that you especially need to know, Ariane, and everyone else can be asked this question because it's classical. You've all got to be able to describe what are the features on ultrasound and then macroscopically when you're in the OR that make a mass more likely to be benign or malignant. And so the things you've got to consider are size, solid or cystic, solid components, excrescences, complex papillations, if there's blood within, if there's an ulcer within, if it's bilateral, if there's ascites, if there's a mental cake, these are all suggestions of malignancy. So be comfortable to discuss that. And then the second question is really more, all of you should be able to say one sentence on this, but those of you who have an ovarian cancer or a borderline tumor need to know just a little bit more. You've got to be able to know what is a tumor of borderline malignancy and what is the prognosis. And that's it. That's really all it is. And the one thing that's missing that you didn't mention is I have to assume you would have transferred it to Gen Onc, and that would then complete the management of the case. Last thing, now I'm a generalist, not a Gen Onc, but Ariane, correct me if I'm wrong. In staging for ovarian cancer, if you rupture the cyst in the process, she immediately becomes stage 3C. Are you familiar with that? Are you aware of that?
My understanding is if it was limited to the ovary, it would be a 1C.
Yes, but by rupturing it at the time of surgery, it now spread throughout the peritoneum, which I understand it to be a 3C. I think I am right, but I'm going to be honest, I'm not 100% sure. But I would ask you particularly, Aaron, to look that up. And anyone who's got a case similar to this, you've got to be able to address that question. Okay? What's the significance of rupturing the tumor, the cyst, during removal? Okay? And other than that, the case is absolutely fine. The management is fine. The fact that she had a bad outcome, and it's not yet necessarily a bad outcome, but the fact that she had a surprising finding, not the end of the world. That happens. So, Ariane, are you comfortable with this case, or do you have other questions about it?
No, that's great. Thank you. I think focusing on the pre-surgery counseling is definitely something to emphasize.
Yeah, just you know, you didn't know at the time that this was a borderline tumor, and so you've got to manage. You know, hindsight is 20/20, but you've got to manage this patient prospectively, and you've got to just share that with your examiner verbally. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, sure. You've got another case, which is a postpartum hysterectomy. So let's hear about that case.
Yes. This patient was a 41-year-old, C3P2. At 36 weeks and 6 days, she had a history of 2 prior C-sections, and her scheduled C-section was moved sooner due to a diagnosis of cholestasis. Her bile acids were 114. This patient received prenatal care by a surgical family medicine physician. I was called after the delivery of the baby for assistance due to the incidental cystotomy that was done, and it was large, approximately 8 centimeters, as well as a concern for placenta accreta. The patient subsequently, I performed a cesarean hysterectomy and bilateral salpingectomy. She did receive blood products, and I repaired 8 centimeter cystotomy, not having your on call.
So I missed that last bit, not having what?
Urology in-house.
Oh,
we had no
urology. Okay. And your concern is your management of the cystotomy.
Correct.
Is that correct? And did you do the C-section, or did the family practice, a few of them do C-sections? Did he or she do the C-section?
It was the family practice physician who
did. So this is a wonderful case. And any one of you listening in who are doing a repeat C-section, which virtually every single one of you have such a case on your case list, this question that I'm going to pose now to Arion can come to you. Arion, you didn't do the C-section. The family practice did and got a substantial cystotomy. How do you suppose the cystotomy might have been caused?
She had 2 prior C-sections, and my understanding was that there was significant dense adhesion even prior to, trying to get...
You're on the right track. Carry on. You're doing good. Carry on. Therefore,
an incidental cystotomy occurred.
How can you reduce... Anytime you go in on a previous C-section and are repeating the C-section, how should you create the bladder flap? Well, let me rephrase the question. When you do a C-section, the first C-section on a patient, how do we create the bladder flap typically? What do we do surgically?
If you're uncertain about the borders of the bladder, you can lift the Foley up to the upper dome.
No, that's not what I'm getting at. What we will often do is put a sponge on our finger and gently push the bladder off the low uterine segment. You with me?
Correct. Mm-hmm, yeah,
correct.
Creating a bladder.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
In a patient who has a prior C-section scar, as you described here, there was a significant scar tissue there. When you try and push that bladder off the lower uterine segment, okay, there are no normal planes that it can just separate off because it's all fibrotic from the previous scar. So the forces don't go normally to separate the bladder. And typically, the forces will, not typically, it's not that uncommon that the forces, when trying to do that, will result in a cystotomy. And for that reason, when creating the bladder flap in a prior C-section patient, you shouldn't use your finger with a swab to push it down, but you should use sharp dissection to avoid that risk of a cystotomy, which I think is exactly what happened here based on how you described it. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I would say surgically it appeared that it was a very clean cut, so it wasn't like a blunt.
Okay. But that may be the case, but I still want you specifically, and everyone listening in, because this is a common issue, all of you have it, I want you all to be aware that one has to be very concerned about using blunt dissection with your finger and a swab to create the bladder flap in a patient who's had a previous C-section, because the forces would be abnormal due to the fibrotic tissue from the old scar. Okay?
Okay.
Just be aware of that. All right. So you had a cystotomy, which you had to repair, and you also had to do a C-hist. So, I mean, I'm going to throw some questions at you, but so what's your concern? This kind of stuff happens. It's not nice, but it happens.
I wouldn't say I'm necessarily concerned about the case. I guess because of the cystotomy, yeah. I mean, it was a difficult surgery, but
sure.
I think...
Look, the patient did okay, yes, at the end of the day?
Yeah.
Fine. That's a medal on your chest that you should be proud of, okay? So this case is a great case. It's a beautiful excuse to set you up for a line of questions that you can really shine. So obviously you need to know management of postpartum hysterectomy all the way up to C-hist. But you've got the added component, which I think will dominate the C-hist aspect. You've got the added component of the cystotomy. And what I would be surprised if they did not ask you this. And what I'm going to share with you now, folks, it goes for everyone with a cystotomy or an enterotomy. Okay, these basic questions you must be able to respond to. So how many layers did you close the bladder? What did each layer comprise of? Was it urothelium? Was it mucosa? Was it muscularis, serosa? What is composed, comprise of? What stitch type did you use? Was it interrupted, continuous, locking, mattress, non-locking? What suture type did you use? Chromic, plain, and why? Vicryl? What was the reason and why? And what are the characteristics of that suture material? This is all fair game, okay? Then post-op, did you leave, or what is your thinking as far as bladder catheter management in a patient such as this? And finally, did you give post-op antibiotics? And if so, which ones and why? And I think that's it. There's one other question you've got to be aware of. And that is, when we get a cystotomy under these circumstances, it can potentially be very close to the trigone. And whereas we are expected to repair the bladder, we are not really expected to know the finesse required to repair the trigone. But it's nice in the exam to be able to say, you know, I looked at the bladder from inside, and I saw that we were clear of the trigone and the ureteric orifices, because if you hit the trigone or the ureteric orifices, the case becomes incredibly more complicated. So if you can say, I looked to see, I was nowhere near there, that really is helpful, okay? So this is a great case. It gives you an opportunity to shine in the exam. Just be ready for those questions. And anytime you get a question on cystotomy, they can ask you about ureteric repair as well, and where is the ureter most commonly injured, okay, under what circumstances, and anatomically where. So those are the questions you need to know, Ariana. And if it's an enterotomy, all those questions that I mentioned initially are exactly the same. Just the ureter part is not a part of it. But what suture material, how did you close end-to-end, side-to-side, what layers, what stitch type, it's all the same thing. Okay, so Ariane, did I answer your question, or you still got some concerns about this case?
No, that's great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure. And obviously, in your situation, as with virtually every one of you, have a blood transfusion on your case list, you've got to be able to, in each and every patient in whom you've got a blood transfusion, you've got to be able to say why you chose to give which blood products. So why did you give packed red blood cells versus whole blood versus FFP versus cryo versus platelets, etc.? And why did you give 2 or 4 or 5 units, okay? One thing I just noticed, all of you listening, you wouldn't realize this, but Ariane, you mentioned on paper in your email to me, you've got written down, she received 4 units of packed red blood cells, 1 unit FFP, and 1 1 unit of platelets. Do you have a problem with anything that I've just said? And I read it straight from your case list.
That the ratio is not...
No, so there is a ratio, but that's not what I'm getting at. How much does 1 unit of platelets raise the platelet count? And I hate to say it, but any of you who've got a platelet transfusion on your list, you've just invited that question. It's a fair question for you, Ariane. Give it your best shot.
I believe it's 10,000.
Yeah, 5 to 10,000, yeah. So you gave 1 unit. Is that correct? Do you think raising the platelet count by 10,000 is going to make any real difference?
No.
Yeah. So what do you think about your transfusion of 1 unit of platelets? Doesn't look good on paper. My question to you is, we often talk about giving a 6-pack or a 10-pack. We give 6 units of platelets at a time, or 10 units of platelets at a time, okay, but not 1 unit. And maybe the way you can defend this is you can say it wasn't 1 unit, it was 1 6-pack or a 10-pack. You understand what I'm saying? That might be the easiest way to get out of it. But if it was genuinely only 1 unit, then you might want to say, you know, this patient received 1 unit. In retrospect, I think this was not really helpful. If one's going to give a platelet transfusion, one should typically give at least 6 units. And that's at the end of the day, you're showing the examiner you understand what the issues are that are involved.
Right.
You understand that? Yeah. But say again, Ariane?
Oh, sorry. It probably was a 6-pack.
That's what I'm suspecting it was. Mm-hmm. So I would say that and be comfortable with it, because if that's what it was, that's what it was. It's totally true. And you can say in the exam, no, that was a six-pack. To give one unit would be piddling in the wind. I mean, if you wouldn't use that expression, but you could say it's hopelessly inadequate since it only raises the platelet count by 5 to 10,000. We need to give at least 6 or 10 units. So you can say that if they bring it up to you. Okay? All right. So you're comfortable with that case? Any other questions on that case?
No, thank you.
All right. Any other questions on anything else, Ariane?
No, that's great. Thank you so much.
All right, you're more than welcome. Folks, for all of you listening in, this is going to be the last teleseminar of the year. And so I just want to share a few thoughts with you. Number one, as you all heard me say at the course, our definitive board prep course, when you go into the exam, just be yourselves. You are all 99-point-something% of you, well-trained. You make good decisions. Just be comfortable to answer the questions in an open and honest fashion and explain why you chose to do X versus Y. It's a conversation. The more you can realize it's a conversation, the better off you'll be. And again, I'm going to tell you, for those of you that are interested, we do have our finishing touches course down in Dallas, designed to be taken the day before the exam. We can also do, for those of you that are interested, a final mock oral session if you've got any last-minute questions. The finishing touches course does include a mock oral session, but a lot of people often want additional time, so they actually set up a one-hour mock oral session in addition. So that's there and available if you should desire. Just all I'm going to say is we are limited in the number of positions and time slots that we have. So if you're interested, let the office know sooner rather than later. It's not uncommon at all that we book up fully and have to turn people away. So if you're thinking about it and you want it, just don't leave it till the last minute. Second last thing I want to say is, since this will be the last opportunity to speak with you, I would ask you, please, your friends and colleagues who are taking the exam next year, please tell them about us. It really helps us tremendously if you can share a good word with them, and only if it's deserved, and I'm confident that it is, based on the feedback that we get. We really get tremendously positive feedback. It's very heartwarming. So if you could share your positive experience with Exampra and encourage them to come to us next year, it really helps us tremendously, and I'd appreciate that very much. I also would ask, after you've taken your exam and you get your results, please share the good news with us. And heaven forbid, even if it's not good, share it with us. We do have the occasional failure, but our failure rate is a fraction of what it is for those who have not attended our courses, etc. So you should feel good that you've attended, because we have a very good track record and our statistics support that. So finally, I'm just going to wish all of you the best of luck, and I just hope you go on to have a wonderful career and it rewards you and gives you everything that you're looking for. So I thank you for all your confidence in us and all of the staff and faculty at Exampro. And again, I wish you all the best of luck in the exam. Thank you so much, everyone, and thank you, Ariane. This then concludes our teleseminar, folks. All the best. Take care.